From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Number of police departments in California are rethinking how they respond to reports of a despondent family member who's intending to do him or herself harm. We'll talk about how that strategy is playing out for family members as well as with officer safety. That's all ahead, along with Film Week in the 11 o'clock hour here on KPCC. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us on this Friday. And you know what Friday means. Film Week comes up in the next hour. We'll hear what our critics think about Richard Linklater's new film, Where'd You Go, Bernadette? Adapted from Maria Semple's very popular novel, Cate Blanchett stars. Also, the Angry Birds movie 2. We'll hear what animation critic Charles Solomon and our other critics think about that. And Good Boys, a comedy rated R, despite the fact the three protagonists are sixth grade boys. That's all coming up, along with other films on Film Week next hour. But first, we begin with an incident that tragically unfolded on Monday, in which California Highway Patrol officer Andre Moye was shot and killed by a suspect whose car was being impounded. He grabbed a rifle out of the vehicle and shot, killing the officer. Now, the father of the shooter in the incident says his son was despondent, going through a number of psychological crises in his life, and that he believes his son was suicidal. This brings to the fore again the issue of what's dubbed suicide by cop, those who turn on law enforcement officers in an effort to get the officers to kill them because the individuals are suicidal. In a recent Los Angeles Times piece by Anita Chabrier, it lays out how a number of California police departments are rethinking the traditional way of responding to despondent calls coming from family members or friends concerned about the well-being of someone close to them. Anita, thank you for joining us to talk about your piece in the Times.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
So you talked with different people in law enforcement, and so what seems to be the growing sense about whether police should respond to these calls?
Well, I want to be really clear that all agencies are continuing to respond to calls like the incident that happened with the CHP. That was actually a traffic stop where there's a public safety issue for other people or there's an actual crime going on or something like that. Where they're rethinking what they're doing are in welfare checks, where someone would call and say, I think my son or my husband or my daughter is suicidal. Can you please come help? With those kind of calls, you're seeing departments take a different approach. In smaller agencies, some of them are simply saying, we are not the best person to respond to this. We're not going to come out. And in larger agencies, you're seeing a push towards some kind of joint response between mental health professionals and the police, simply because a lot of times if it's just officers responding to these situations, they do escalate to violence.
Well, and I would think even with larger departments who have the resources to take mental health professionals out, you know, with the officers, there's even a time element there because you've got officers who might be on patrol who could quickly respond to a call of a despondent individual, they're not necessarily going to have that degree of, you know, quick access to a mental health pro to be a part of that team. And did the larger departments talk about that challenge?
Absolutely. I mean, it is very rare still, you're correct, to have that kind of joint response. But one thing that is interesting is that police across the state are saying that being there quickly isn't always the best thing. So that there is a benefit to taking a step back, to assessing the situation, to giving time and space to these calls, to make sure that you're not having to de-escalate and that you don't, and instead you're not escalating in the first place.
You write in your piece that a fairly high percentage of engagement between law enforcement officers, use of force, are these incidents where police say that, you know, it's an individual is essentially trying to kill him or herself by attacking the officers. So what you know, how frequent is this?
Well, there's two sides of that. One side of it is that there is a strong feeling from some in the community that suicide by cop is too often used as an excuse for escalation, that it is something that is very hard to pin down because many times the person who is perhaps has committed suicide by cop or done that is, you know, they can't tell you what they were thinking. So there is that sense that maybe it's a term that's too often used, and it hasn't been studied too much. But there was one 2009 study that looked at 707 cases across the country of officer-involved shootings and found that 36% of those were a suicide by cop situation. So it potentially is a large percentage of officer-involved shootings that has this mental health component to it.
Yeah, and it doesn't seem like it would be that hard to come up with some degree of accuracy in the numbers. If you've got someone, a call's come in that they're suicidal or despondent, they're armed and confronting law enforcement officers. I mean, obviously you could make the case that law enforcement could do more to de-escalate a particular incident, but that's in that kind of a separate issue as to whether the person is attempting to get the officer to kill him or herself.
It just gets complicated, as all mental health things do. What the study found is that a lot of the suicide by cop situations were not pre-planned. Maybe it was someone who was despondent and then in the moment became aggressive. The study did find is that of those suicide by cop situations, 80% of them were armed, 60% of them were armed with a gun. So it is a volatile situation that is difficult for officers to handle.
We're talking with Los Angeles Times reporter Anita Chabrier. She's based in Sacramento, covers state politics, but wrote a very interesting piece just about a week ago now in the LA Times that's titled Police Fear Suicide by Cop Cases, So They've Stopped Responding to Some Calls. And she highlights the Plumas County Sheriff's Office, Sheriff Coroner Greg Hagwood joining us to talk about his department's policy. Now, Plumas County is a rural area, Sierra Nevada area. Sheriff Hagwood, thank you very much for being with us. What's your new policy for these calls?
Our new policy is designed around the goal of creating a success rate for people in psychiatric crisis that if there is a situation where other individuals are at risk or being threatened, of course, our obligation is to keep people safe. Individuals who are threatening suicide, who are alone, who are not posing a threat to anybody besides themselves. Our policy is geared around accessing different resources and not creating a confrontation that has been pointed out. There are countless examples of, I think, unnecessary confrontations that end up with the individual either dying or being injured. And the whole goal is to prevent those confrontations when possible.
So your concern is that when you have deputies who go out on a call for someone who's suicidal and might be armed, that it would make it worse to have deputies arrive on the scene than if they don't show?
Very often we see time and time again examples where officers show up with the best intentions, but the actions or intents of the individual compel a confrontation that has a very, very poor outcome. And I have stated that, you know, historically law enforcement officers and I think the public look to us to be the solution to all problems. And in these circumstances, I believe that there's probably a better way of dealing with a person in a psychiatric crisis than having a direct confrontational experience with armed sheriff's deputies or police officers.
Let me bring into the conversation Pepperdine University Associate Professor of Psychology, Judy Ho, who's licensed clinical and forensic psychologist. Professor Ho, good to have you back with us. What options are there for family members if in some of these departments, particularly in rural areas where, you know, there aren't psychological teams to go out with deputies or with police officers, what's available to family members if they've got someone who's despondent and armed and, you know, threatening to kill themselves? Where do families turn?
So this is a very good question, Larry, and I think that families oftentimes don't know what they can do and they feel hopeless about their ability to help these individuals. But, you know, being connected with that person is key, and keeping tabs on them, calling them, showing up at their house, asking to take them out to be with other family members and friends so that you can really get a, you know, a handle on the pulse of what's going on. And at the same time, if you're not sure how to handle or approach an individual who is saying that they wish to die or is actually even planning some kind of plot to hurt themselves, it's always helpful to call a National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. Those hotlines are not just for the people who are feeling suicidal. They're for the family members to also get advice on how to handle it and how to deal with it in a way that may or may not need to escalate to a point where they have to involve local law enforcement. And so the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 800-273-8255, and they're available 24 hours every day. And I've had many patients whose families have gotten a lot of great advice from talking to one of the advisors on these calls, and sometimes we'll even initiate the call and then go over to the family member's house who's talking about hurting themselves and then have them engage in that call together. So I think that that is, you know, one really good way to approach this. Another way, if the family member is concerned and the person who is suicidal is still willing to engage with a family member but doesn't want to go too much further than that, is for the family member to ask them whether or not they would be willing to accompany them to an emergency room. And sometimes when they are asked to do this, the person who wants to hurt themselves is willing to do it if the family member will go with them. And so the family member holds their hand, drives them, takes them every step of the way, and they go to the emergency room together to get evaluated, possibly for admission for a 5150. And of course, that is not necessarily, you know, a long-term treatment plan, but it at least helps the individual to not hurt themselves in that moment when they're very, very despondent. I also want to say that these research studies that we have on individuals who do attempt suicide by cop, that oftentimes there's other things in their history that, you know, would be important to address. For example, there's more than 50% of them in some of these studies that show that they're at the time intoxicated on alcohol or drugs, which of course then really might sort of kind of cut into their impulse control and make them make more rash decisions in the moment. And so that's clearly something that's very important to address. And interestingly enough, one of these studies also has shown that individuals who really talk about a high degree of religiosity sometimes will be in such a dire situation to think about utilizing this concept, because in their mind they believe that if they take their own life then they might not gain access to the afterlife, but that if somebody else does it to them then perhaps they still could. And it's interesting talking to these individuals, you know, afterwards and talking about their state of mind at the time, what led them to do that in that moment, that those were some of the concerns. And so I think kind of knowing that some of these things are risk factors or things that we should at least address and talk about with these individuals who want to harm themselves would be important.
Professor Ho, thank you very much. Appreciate your being with us again on Air Talk.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
Associate Professor of Psychology at Pepperdine, Judy Ho, joining us. She has a new book out next week, Stop Self-Sabotage. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We're going to continue our conversation on what's dubbed suicide by cop, where someone who is threatening his or her life comes at police officers in the hopes that they will be killed in that confrontation and that they don't have to turn the weapon on themselves, take their own life. Question is, how should law enforcement respond to those calls that come in with someone who is despondent? What we heard from the Plumas County Sheriff and Coroner Greg Hagwood is that if there's a case where no one else is being threatened by the person that is suicidal, they are not going to come out immediately out of concern that that encounter may make the situation worse. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. How should law enforcement respond to calls of despondent individuals who are armed, threatening harm to themselves? That's the question taken up in a Los Angeles Times piece by Anita Chabrier, a piece that looked at a number of different departmental policies and how those law enforcement agencies choose to respond to those calls. At Plumas County in the Sierra Nevada Hills, they've made a conscious decision that if there's not an imminent threat to other individuals by the person who is at risk of harming him or herself, they will not immediately come out and engage with the individual out of concern that it makes the situation worse. With us, retired Los Angeles Police Department Sergeant Cheryl Dorsey. She worked with the LAPD, rising the rank of sergeant between 1980 and 2000. Sergeant Dorsey, good to have you with us again. What do you think is the best way for police to respond to calls of despondent individuals threatening self-harm?
Well, you know, having spent 20 years in patrol and responded and been involved in incidents like this, I know personally firsthand that sometimes people are really just asking for help. It's a cry for help. It's a way to get attention. And I've been involved in situations where our officers have been successful in talking someone down, in getting them to get off that ledge or come off of the rooftop of that building. And so to think that a police department, someone who has taken an oath to protect and serve, would not respond because you're fearful of your presence being confrontational and causing this situation to exacerbate is offensive, and it's cowardly. This is what police officers are trained and expected to do. It's inherent to what we do. And so if you're confident in your skill set and your training and you rely on that, why wouldn't you respond to help someone who's in need? And if this is the policy of police departments across the nation now to not respond because they don't want to upset somebody, it would be nice if they use that same mindset when folks are calling the police unnecessarily on Black people who are just living while Black, that new term, and exacerbate the situation. So listen, there's a way to do this. We should do this. And I hope that police officers won't refuse to respond when someone calls them and asks for their assistance.
Well, one of the concerns, of course, that we hear from law enforcement is they're damned if they do, they're damned if they don't. If they respond and the suicidal individual, you know, comes at them while armed or raises a weapon to get them, the officer has to respond to protect her, himself, or you know, colleagues in a situation like that. Is it fair to the officers to have to be in that position to kill someone because that individual is at that point in his or her life where they want to end it?
Well, listen, here's the problem with that is that we don't know ever what someone's intent is when we interact with them. We don't know what an intent is. Obviously, recently in Riverside, California, a traffic stop, something that should be relatively simple and easy, and it turned into an officer losing his life. So we have to rely on our training, and that's why officers are trained the way that they are because instances and circumstances can change in a moment. And so, listen, I say all the time that everybody who wants to be the police should not be the police. Some of what we do is unavoidable. And if someone points a weapon at an officer, that officer has the affirmative responsibility to defend himself and should defend himself. And then, you know, let the chips fall where they may. We didn't precipitate that use of deadly force. And so I think if you are well-trained, as we are in the Los Angeles Police Department, we trust our training, we'll trust our instincts, and we can respond to any and every call appropriately, and it will end in the way that it's supposed to. And if it ends in a death, then it ends in a death. It's part of the territory. It comes with the job.
We're talking with Cheryl Dorsey, retired sergeant with the Los Angeles Police Department. Also with us, Greg Hagwood of the Plumas County Sheriff's Office, where he is the sheriff, as well as the county coroner. Sheriff Hagwood, you want to respond to what Sergeant Dorsey just said?
Every situation, no two situations are identical. I am simply looking at those incidences, those situations where there might be a better address to the individual in crisis than an armed law enforcement officer. Is there a better resource from a behavioral health expert, people who specialize in people in psychiatric crisis? Now, law enforcement officers are increasingly better trained, and I welcome that trend in terms of de-escalation and not forcing unnecessary use of force. But there are instances that I think are better addressed by someone other than an armed law enforcement officer. And this policy is not being utilized, not just in California, but across the country, out of cowardice. It is being examined and implemented in a sincere effort to have a better outcome and reduce the possibility of a use of force.
But isn't time of the essence in these cases? So, yes, ideally there'd be someone specially trained in just these kinds of incidents, mental health professional who you'd be able to, you know, call on, or a family member could call on right away. They'd dispatch in the same way one of your deputies would go out to the call. But just realistically, you've got a family member who says, my loved one has gone out to the garage with his gun, and I fear that, you know, he's going to hurt himself. Wouldn't a deputy who's ideally trained in de-escalation and helping to talk someone through that life crisis be able to get there and potentially successfully intervene more quickly than a mental health professional?
I think in terms of response, obviously on-duty law enforcement officers have the ability to arrive at a situation in a more timely fashion than a mental health or behavioral health specialist. The goal is to reduce the confrontation. And if there is a way to communicate with that individual without anybody being put at risk, if somebody has a firearm and they are threatening suicide and they're alone, yeah, we could show up and they could point the gun at us and we would return fire and perhaps kill that individual. The idea that that's just the course of business, I think I just can't subscribe to that just being the cost of doing business. I think there are better ways to address these situations. I think you're going to see approaches, policy, training continue to evolve. And to the extent that this is the this is the destination and we've arrived there when it comes to addressing the situations, I think we have to look at constantly improving, constantly evaluating, but at the same time doing everything we can to avoid these unnecessary deaths.
We're talking with Greg Hagwood, who's Plumas County Sheriff as well as coroner. Let me go back to L.A. Times reporter Anita Chabrier. Anita, is much of this a rural versus urban divide in law enforcement approach?
Absolutely not, which is what I find fascinating about it. You're going to see we're about to change our use of force here in California. There, we had a bill, 392, many people have heard about. The governor's going to get ready to sign it that updates use of force in California. That actually came out of a – much of what's in that bill came out of a suicide response in San Diego County in 2006 for a man named Shane Hayes, where deputies there were called to a suicidal man. They went into the house, and the gentleman had a knife in his hand. It was not clear that he was threatening anybody, but officers felt threatened, and they fired and killed him. What that did, that case went through civil litigation, and it made it so that in California on the civil side, what an officer does leading up to the deadly confrontation can be examined in a civil case. Prior to that, it was only the moment of death that could, was that person a danger at the moment of death? 392 will make that, bring that to the criminal side. So starting very shortly in California, what an officer does leading up to the deadly confrontation can be examined for, were they proper in their tactics and their response? And so I think that across the state, there's going to be even greater emphasis than there already is on what officers are doing leading up to the deadly force. So I think that this is actually the start of a larger conversation on how our police respond when they face deadly threats.
And then on the opposite side of that, if you have departments that routinize not responding to calls of individuals in crisis, you know, unless there is someone else who's threatened by that individual, could that open up the door to liability from the other direction?
Of course. I mean, I think that it's going to be an interesting conversation because many of the people I spoke to, including George Quinn's family, the gentleman who did kill himself in Plumas County, feel that they deserved help, that they're not the right person to be doing this, and that let's say that had been a suicide by cop situation, were they better equipped to confront someone with a weapon? So I definitely think that this is going to be an ongoing conversation in a developing situation.
Let me quickly go back to Cheryl Dorsey, retired LAPD sergeant. Sergeant Dorsey, to your knowledge, is there much training of law enforcement officers going through the academy or in-service training to deal with these kinds of scenarios?
Well, you know, I can't speak to the 18,000 police departments that are across the nation because everyone is different, and I understand that. But I've often said that poor tactics lead to deadly uses of force. And so this is something, this AB 392 being passed, and I spoke on Capitol Hill on the state capitol about this because I think officers should give great consideration to the tactics that they use leading up to a situation. When we get to a scene, it's our responsibility to deal with a situation, confront violence, if you will, uncooperative people, and then de-escalate. And a lot of times what we're seeing is that officers get personally invested, whether the person is mentally ill or not, and then it becomes a mission of, I'm going to punish you because you didn't comply, because you didn't turn around, because you ran. And so the tactics are very, very important, and it should give an officer reason to pause before they take a life, before right. they use deadly force.
I want to thank you, Sergeant Cheryl Dorsey, retired LAPD sergeant. My thanks to Los Angeles Times reporter Anita Chabrier, whose piece on this just shy of a week ago looked at how different California law enforcement agencies are dealing with those in mental health distress threatening self-harm. Also, our thanks to Greg Hagwood, Plumas County Sheriff, as well as coroner, and Judy Ho, professor of psychology. psychology at Pepperdine University. We'll continue looking at an important new study about the effects of air pollution on the lungs of older Americans. That after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We're just about 20 minutes from Film Week. Our critics this week tell us about Richard Linklater's new film, Where'd You Go, Bernadette, based on Maria Semple's best-selling novel. Cate Blanchett stars. The Angry Birds movie 2 is out. We'll hear what our critics, including animation expert Charles Solomon, thinks of it. And Good Boys, which stars three young actors portraying sixth graders in an R-rated comedy. Those and more films coming up on Film Week. But first, we turn our attention to a new study published this week in the Journal of the American Medical Association, which followed 7,000 participants in six cities across the U.S., including Los Angeles, over a nearly two-decade period, looking at the effect of air pollution on their lungs. Joining us from Columbia University, senior author of that study, Professor of Medicine and Epidemiology, Dr. R. Graham Barr. Dr. Barr, good to have you with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm delighted to join.
This study shows quite concerningly that continuous exposure to air pollution can have the effect on the lungs like smoking a pack a day of cigarettes. Elaborate, please, on that finding.
Sure. We've been interested to try to understand why chronic lung disease has been going up and is the third leading cause of death globally and the fourth leading cause of death in the U.S., despite really fairly sizable reductions in current cigarette smoking in the U.S. Over the last five decades or so. And there's been a lot of concern that ozone at the ground level that we all breathe in, particularly during the summer, may cause reactions in the lung that lead to lung damage. So in this study, we had the opportunity to estimate people's ozone exposure and exposure to other air pollutants in Los Angeles and five other metropolitan areas, as you mentioned, and followed what their lungs looked like on CT scans or CAT scans over the next 10 to 18 years, and found that really there was an acceleration of age-related.
I'm sorry, we're having such technical problems with Dr. Barr's phone. We're going to have to get that squared away. My apologies that we've got such a bad signal there. We're talking about the research done out of Columbia University. Dr. Graham Barr joining us, also with us from USC, which has been doing extensive studies over recent years looking at the effects on children's lungs living in areas of Southern California where they're exposed to higher concentrations of air pollution. Ed Aval, he's professor of clinical preventive medicine at USC. Thank you very much, Professor Aval, for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's an important topic to talk about.
So as you look at this study, which again looks at adults, and I know you and your colleagues at SC have been looking at younger populations, what for you is this sort of the longer term implication of what you found in kids?
Well, yeah, I think it sort of leads to, you know, that you look at the whole lifespan and think about what this means. From our perspective, we're interested in all children getting as healthy and as robust a start in life as they can. And so, you know, it turns out that what happens early in life has lifelong implications. And what Graham's study has shown is that, in fact, some of those lifelong implications are not so good if they follow years and years of being exposed to air pollution, particularly during the summer, for example, here in Los Angeles.
And describe for us in the work that you and others on the team at USC, what you found about some of the geographic differences based on, you know, where kids are growing up relative to stationary sources of pollution and freeways.
So what we did was study several thousand children across Central and Southern California, and we followed those children from the time they entered public elementary school until the time they graduated from high school, and then from several thousand of them, we've actually followed them even after they left school. And what we found by making measurements of their lung function, keeping track of their symptoms, tracking their medication and so forth through questionnaires and interviews, is that those children growing up in more polluted areas, areas of higher ozone, higher particulates, higher nitrogen oxides in the air, those children had slower growing lungs. They didn't grow as quickly compared to their peers in cleaner places. And by the time they graduated from high school, by the time their lungs were close to maturity, they actually were physically smaller. They didn't have the capacity, they didn't have the volumes that they could blow through their airways. And so in many ways, you know, they were being set up for sort of a life of sub-maximal health, because we know that lung function is a predictor of sort of respiratory health throughout your life.
And could that make it more likely that the individual later in life would have, you know, COPD, emphysema, other lung problems, that development of the lungs could raise the risk of that?
Well, it certainly is suggestive of that. And again, Graham's looked at the later in life, so the other end of the spectrum here. But the sort of in a simplified way of thinking about this, you know, we all grow through our late teens, early 20s in terms of lung function, and then we all sort of reach that plateau in the mid-20s, and then there's a slow but steady decline as we age. And it's a little faster if you're a smoker, a little faster if you have occupational exposures, a little faster if you're genetically predisposed to it, a little faster potentially if you have been exposed to air pollution. But everybody loses some loss of function as they age, and the issue is how fast does that decline happen. And what we're seeing on the later years with some of the work done here on the Mesa Air study is that that can lead to emphysematic type changes.
We're talking with USC Professor of Clinical Preventive Medicine Ed Avall. He and other researchers at USC have looked over time at the effects of air pollution on younger developing lungs. Also with us from Columbia University, Professor of Medicine and Epidemiology, Dr. R. Graham Barr, who's the senior author of the study published this week in the Journal of the American Medical Association. It looks at air pollution, especially ground level ozone, and the apparent link in increases in emphysema, COPD, problems with older lungs. If you have questions for our two researchers, we're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Dr. Barr, I didn't realize that we're seeing similar levels of emphysema in older Americans now as we did decades ago when many more people smoked. I mean, could some of this be related to the fact there's just a lag time and that many of these people smoked earlier in their lives?
Yeah, that's a great question. There certainly is a lag in that when if one smokes, the best one thing one can do for one's health is to quit. And the sort of the health benefit of quitting is almost immediate for cardiovascular disease. And by 5 years, it's kind of gone from cardiovascular. For cancer, it's like 15 years. But unfortunately, for lung disease, the risk persists all your life. And that is because it's certainly always better to quit, but because as was pointing out, the lungs grow over time, and then around, you know, between 20 and 35, you hit your peak lung growth and then decline with age-related declines. The hit from smoking stays with you over time. So that we are seeing some lag from the many people in the population quitting, you know, 30 or 40 years ago. But there's not as much of a reduction as you would expect based on changes in smoking in the U.S. over the last 50 years.
Here in Southern California, as you know, I'm sure you well know, despite the fact you're in New York, we've seen a dramatic decrease in visible air pollution, catalytic converters on cars, being one of the huge factors in allowing us to see mountains that during the summer would be invisible in many, particularly valley areas of greater Los Angeles. You know, do we have a sense of Dr. Barr, how that's, you know, playing into these numbers, and with those improvements, might we see the number, you know, emphysema drop?
Yeah, we certainly hope so. In this study, we were following air pollution levels in Los Angeles and other metropolitan areas from about 2000 through last year. And absolutely, there's an impressive drop in particulate matters and nitrogen oxidized species. And indeed, we saw much stronger associations for particulate matter and NOx and black carbon if we looked at people's exposures in around 2000-2002 than when we looked over the study period. In other words, the declines that we've seen in particularly in LA over the last 20 years, we hope really are, and I think the study suggests, are having some beneficial effects. Unfortunately, ozone, which has not been addressed in many of the regulations put in over the last couple of decades, it did not drop in Los Angeles and has not dropped in the center of the areas we studied, and that was where we saw the strongest and most consistent association between both the amount of ozone exposure in 2000 and 2002 and the amount of ozone exposure over the study period and worsening lung or greater emphysema in the lungs.
We're talking with Dr. Graham Barr, Columbia University. Also with us, Ed Aval of USC. We're talking with the two researchers about the exposure to air pollution, what it does to both the developing younger person's lungs, what also we see later in life with evidence of emphysema, was generally called COPD. We'll continue our conversation in 1 minute on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We're just 8 minutes away from Film Week. We'll be talking with our critics Amy Nicholson, Wade Major, and Charles Solomon. Got a bunch of movies to talk about, including the Angry Birds movie 2 and the comedic mystery drama Where'd You Go, Bernadette, starring Cate Blanchett. That's just a few minutes away. Film Week here on 89.3. And as I speak, the critics are entering the room. There they are. The team is assembling, ready to come in. Right now, we're talking about the effects of exposure to ground-level ozone, as well as to airborne particulates on the developing lungs, as well as over time, what it means for older individuals who've been exposed to ground-level ozone, as well as to particulates. If you have questions for our two lung researchers, please join us now, 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Ed Aval of USC, Professor of Clinical Preventive Medicine. Elliot writes on the page, what's the best way to find out what the exposure is to these air quality challenges and find, you know, which neighborhoods are safer to live in?
Well, that's a good question, and actually the information is available at your fingertips, both through an app and on the web, through the Air Now or even at aqmd.gov, which lists hourly data, real-time data across the basin, and you can just sort of look at the map, or you can type in different areas at airnow.gov and sort of see what the pollution is shaping up to be and how it's changing, both for the previous days as well as for the day as it's developing in your area. One other thing I might mention in terms of the ozone is a clear pollutant, that is, you can't see it. And so, although there is an improvement, there has been a noticeable improvement in air quality in Los Angeles over the last few decades, We now can see the mountains, as you mentioned, Larry. Ozone, although it has come down some, as Graham suggested, has sort of bottomed out and seems to possibly be even going back up a little bit now. And so why that is has to do with a number of issues, but it turns out that ozone and particulates are the two remaining national ambient air quality standards for which Los Angeles is still in violation, in non-compliance. We do not meet the state or federal standards.
And Ed, is ozone sensitive to sunlight and temperature? Is that perhaps one of the factors?
That's exactly part of the issue. I mean, ozone is driven by photochemical reactions in the air with a number of direct emissions from tailpipes and power plants and smokestacks and so forth, but is driven by the ultraviolet radiation of the sun. So when we have these long summer days with stagnant weather, it literally sits and cooks in the air here.
And with more cars on the road, which has been well documented, that means you have more tailpipe emissions fueling this too.
Absolutely.
All right. When you look at the differences in kids between areas of dirtier air and cleaner air, when you project that out, what sort of difference are we looking at? Potential physical capabilities?
Well, what we were seeing in our studies is that the difference from sort of the cleanest to the most polluted communities might be a percent or percent and a half of lung function growth per year, which doesn't seem like a big amount, but over the course of 10 or 12 years for a child going through the teen years, actually turns out to be significant by the time they get to age 18 and then going on through their life. So, it seems like they're losing a little bit each year, but that's incremental change is happening over the course of several years.
And Graham Barr, we've had questions about home air purification, if that can make a substantial difference in filtering out ozone as well as particulates. What do you think?
Well, actually, first of all, what was studied was mainly ambient or entirely ambient or outdoor ozone levels. But most ozone really is outside and doesn't penetrate into homes very well. So even without an air purifier, et cetera, you're indoors, one is not exposed as much to ozone at all. It's not 100%, but really most of this is an outdoor issue, or for that matter, outdoors includes when you're in your car on the highway. But in terms of penetrating into homes, much less so.
Also, I assume, Ed Avall, a lot of this has to do with people being out exposed and kids exerting themselves in polluted air.
Right. So it's a matter not only of time of day, but also location, where you are, when you exercise. I mean, I think the important message for the public is that exercise is good for you. We all need to get more exercise. We're all too sedentary, and exercise would do us all a world of good. But where and when you exercise does matter.
All right, gentlemen, thank you very much. Appreciate your being with us, talking about the research that each of you and your teams are involved with. That's Ed Avall of USC, Professor of Clinical Preventive Medicine. His research focusing on airborne pollutants, particularly among younger Angelenos, and Dr. Graham Barr, Columbia University Professor of Medicine and Epidemiology. He's senior author of the study published this week in the Journal of the American Medical Association, followed 7,000 participants, 6 U.S. cities, including Los Angeles, over nearly 2 decades, finding that ground-level exposure to ozone, that there is a negative effect on lung capacity and a higher incidence of COPD emphysema for those who are more exposed. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Reminder that after Film Week, Fresh Air with Terry Gross coming up at noon right here on 89.3. We're going to tell you about all the movies that are coming up momentarily.
It's
Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle, joined this week by critics Amy Nicholson, film writer for The Guardian and host of the podcast Unspooled and the podcast miniseries Zoom. Charles Solomon, film critic for Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine, and Wade Major of Synagogues.com. All of them, of course, most importantly, of Film Week. And we're going to get right into the reviews this week. We begin with Where'd You Go, Bernadette? A loving mom decides to reconnect with her creativity after raising her family. Cate Blanchett stars. Richard Linklater is the director and co-screenwriter. Wade?
Love this movie. It might be one of my favorite Linklater films. Linklater is such a diverse filmmaker. You can never tell when one of his films is a Linklater film. He doesn't have a signature that sort of establishes his sensibilities. He's so versatile, and he stretches sometimes in ways that are really exhilarating. If it's something like, the Beyond films or Dazed and Confused, Boyhood, you feel him in those. This is something that is really kind of outside his experience. Cate Blanchett is a woman who is a very successful architect and then just kind of imploded for some reason. And she's married to Billy Crudup, who's a tech guy. They have a daughter and things aren't quite right in their lives. She's not working. She's just kind of not even doing anything with this old house that they've moved into in Seattle. And it's about how she discovers why she's so angry and frustrated, why she fights with the neighbors like Kristen Wiig, why she's so bitter. And it's one of those sort of existential journeys back to life again. And it's so positive is the beautiful thing here. The characters are so affirming. It doesn't have that Hollywood cynicism that we're so accustomed to. And that's what's nice. Linklater is really an optimist. And he brings such a beautiful sheen to this thing. And he takes his time. It's paced in a really wonderful way. You never feel like this is a Hollywood structure. Here we are getting to the 30-minute mark and something's got to happen. Things just happen in their own time and in their own pace. And you just sit back and you have an absolutely wonderful time with these characters. It's a beautiful film.
Now, not that you've necessarily read the novel by Maria Semple,
no,
on which it's based, but do you have any sense of how faithful it is to the novel or how far Linklater went from it?
I did hear from a couple of people that it's faithful to the novel in spirit, is what they said. So I don't take that for what it is, but they say it's faithful to the novel in spirit. I think Cate Blanchett could well get, if this film has legs into award season, she could be a dark horse for another nomination.
We're talking about Where'd You Go, Bernadette? Richard Linklater directing. He co-wrote it with Holly Gent and Vincent Palmo Jr. And the film is rated PG-13. It's in wide release. John Horn of The Frame earlier this week spoke with Richard Linklater about the film. We have a link on our Film Week page where you can hear John's conversation with Linklater. The Angry Birds Movie 2, animated feature that's directed by Thurop Van Oren. Peter Ackerman is the writer of The Angry Birds Movie 2. Charles, what'd you think?
Well, the first Angry Birds movie came out and the game was already passé. And I mean, who plays Angry Birds anymore? You know, they've moved on to Candy Crush or something. So it feels unnecessary, but so much of the film is on the nose and so on the nose that for the last half hour, I was giving the dialogue with the characters before they started speaking as, oh, this is where he's going to say this. And, you know, Red, who was the hero of the first film, has to learn that just being the hero and claiming everything for himself isn't important, that, you know, there are other things in life. There's a rather obnoxious new female character who's an engineer and, of course, solves all the problems. And I kept contrasting her within the My Hero Academia movie. There was a brilliant young girl who was an engineer who had really interesting things to say and do in the story rather than this sort of by-the-numbers stuff. And so I was just, you know, looking at my watch and saying, how much more of this do I have to watch for Larry?
I appreciate it, Charles.
But showing with this is an absolutely charming short film called Hair Love. It was funded by a huge Kickstarter campaign. They raised more than $300,000. It was written by Matthew Cherry, who co-directed it, the ex-NFL player, about an African-American father trying to fix his little daughter's hair on a very important day. And it is warm and charming and funny with the humor coming out of their characters and their situations. It's everything Angry Birds isn't. I wouldn't be surprised if it turns out to be an Oscar nominee in the short category. It's just a delightful little film that's so worth seeing and deserves better company.
What's the title again of the
Hair
short
Love.
Film? Hair Love.
Hair Love.
All right. And that is the opener for the Angry Birds 2 movie, which is in wide release, rated PG. The adventure comedy Good Boys is directed by Gene Stupnitsky, about 3 sixth graders who ditch school and go on a long journey to try and make their way home in time for a party.
There's so many girls at the party. You know what that means?
Drama.
No, kissing.
You do not want to go to Soren's party not knowing how to kiss.
We could spy on my neighbor. She's a total nymphomaniac.
She starts fires?
No, she's a nymphomaniac. Someone who has sex on land and sea.
Good Boys, ironically sixth graders in an R-rated film. Amy, what'd you think?
This movie is terrific. This is a sort of big, gigantic studio comedy I wish the studios were making more of. This might be my favorite big studio comedy of the year. I mean, as you can hear from this film, it is definitely rated R. It is not for sixth graders. I'm sorry if there are any sixth graders listening or the parents of them. I strongly encourage you to secretly get this movie and watch at a slumber party. I think it would be terrific.
They actually made part of the marketing campaign. You have to be so tall to see the film as a joke about
it. I mean, and that makes sense because a lot of the comedy here in this movie is about this gulf between these three boys who are fascinated by everything, by hormones, by what they've heard about what grown-up life is going to be like, by alcohol. This huge gulf between what they think they know about what all of these things are and then what they actually know. And of course, they're braggadocious, so they're always bragging about these things that they have no idea about. And it really does have this wonderful sixth-grade boy mindset. You know, this world where everybody's bragging about, can you have one sip of beer? Well, I dare you to take two sips of beer. And it really does exist on that level of comedy, but it's just terrific. And yeah, the plot is about this all-day Rube Goldberg adventure that these three best friends embark on to make it to the sixth-grade kissing party, which is very important for one of them, and that's Jacob Tremblay, who people know from Room, who I love that his parents were like, you can be in this Oscar movie, and now go for it. Have so much fun in this one. And it's him, and there's a kid who's more of the theater type, and then there's a kid who's this absolute upstanding good kid who just keeps blurting out things he should not be blurting out to authority figures and cops. And it's just terrific. I had so much fun watching this. The audience in my theater was laughing and losing their minds. I really hope people go and check this one out. It feels kind of just what you want to see in the summer. That's not a franchise film.
Gene Stupnitsky and Lee Eisenberg wrote the screenplay. Stupnitsky directed the film. Jacob Tremblay, Brady Noon, Keith L. Williams are the stars. Good Boys is rated R. It's in wide release. Blinded by the Light, a story of a British-Pakistani teenager back in 1987. The film is a comedic drama with music. Wade, what'd you think?
I thoroughly enjoy this. And, you know, conflict of interest week for me here. I have friends who've produced films for Gurinder Chadha in the past, and I just have a natural inclination to love her movies. Bend It Like Beckham, Bride and Prejudice, Bollywood musical. She has a wonderful sensibility about how these South Asian British culture clashes sort of position themselves in British society in particular. And Bend It Like Beckham was all a great deal about that. And there's a lot of that here, too. What I'm afraid is that people are going to superficially connect this to Yesterday because, well, they're both about, you know, the lead character in each of them is Pakistani. One's about, you know, his obsession with the Beatles. The other one is about his obsession with Bruce Springsteen. So therefore, these movies are analogous. They're not at all. Yesterday doesn't make any issue of race or ethnicity. Yesterday simply has that as a character, simply, you know, because that's the best actor they had. And it's a fantasy, and it's a wonderful fantasy. This is based on an actual memoir. This is based on a memoir by Sarfraz Manzoor, who really did become obsessed with Bruce Springsteen in the 80s, who kind of found himself in this cultural melange, you know, Pakistani family, but he wants to be British. And here's an American singer that somehow brings it all together and makes it OK to be, you know, who you are, who you really are. And it's really quite a wonderful story, the way it's told. It's earnest and it's heartfelt. And it takes place, obviously, right in the middle of Thatcher era England. And it's able to make commentary on that without the characters being lost in that commentary. It's really a very, very sweet film. And you know, I'm not a huge Bruce Springsteen fan, and I remember the era very well, and there are some songs I like, but there is something infectious about the way that he is able to incorporate those lyrics into his life, and the way that Gurinder finds to sort of externalize his appreciation for the lyrics, even though he's listening on headphones through much of the film. There are devices that she relies on to kind of bring it to you, to bring you close to the characters. It pans out very nicely.
Now, Gurinder Chadha, if her previous films had wide release like this one?
I don't know how wide. Bend It Like Beckham did very, very well.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That was
the one that really, really put her on the map.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
That was all over the place. Blinded by the Light is the film. It's rated PG-13 and is in wide release. Ready or Not, a horror thriller directed by Matt Bettinelli-Olpin and Tyler Gillette, tells the story of a bride's wedding night, which takes a sinister turn when her eccentric in-laws force her to take part in a terrifying game.
So, at midnight, you have to play a game. It's just something we do when someone new joins the family.
A game? What game? Hide and seek? Are we really gonna play that?
Well, the rules are simple. You can hide anywhere. We then try to find you. Good luck.
Ready or Not is co-written by Guy Busick and R. Christopher Murray. It's the screenwriting debut for both of them, and Ready or Not. Amy, what'd you think?
Yeah, so the family here that is hosting this game is kind of, imagine like an evil Milton Bradley family. Like if the Milton Bradley family was this gigantic, cruel one percenter dynasty that had made this billionaire fortune on board games. And so, yes, when you marry into this family, one of the hurdles you have to leap over in order to join this basically Kennedys of gaming is you have to play a game that's picked at random from this box. And it could be Twister, it could be Go Fish. In this case, she gets hide and go seek, where if they find her, they kill her. And it's all in order of for this family to appease what they believe is this kind of spirit that gave the family the luck in order to be rich. And if they don't do this, they're going to lose all their money.
This is played straight. It sounds so comedic.
It does start a little bit like Clue, which I liked. And then it gets incredibly gory, which I was not expecting. And, you know, I think if I'd been prepped for the gore, I would have been a little bit more on the gore ride. The gore sort of shows up and you're like, whoa, I was not expecting that in this film. But it does go very, very hard on the 1%. So I can imagine a lot of people hooting and cheering as they watch this. I really love the setup here. I love the premise. Samara Weaving, who plays the bride, she really starts off this film with just this radiance. You just see her in her wedding dress, her glee when she looks at her husband-to-be, how much she loves him. And you adore her, and you're very much on her side. I think that she does a really terrific job. She's an Australian actress who basically looks exactly like Margot Robbie. So if you can't afford Margot Robbie, I highly recommend a Samara Weaving. And then, of course, you get like the sort of tough girl moments where she swaps out her heels for sneakers and starts running around and tearing off all the tulle. And, you know, it's predictable and sometimes a little bit unsteady. There's some stuff I wish worked better than it did. But it was fun. It was fun.
Ready or Not, rated R. It's in wide release starting next Wednesday, the 21st of August. Ready or Not. American Factory, a documentary which is streaming on Netflix starting next week. Amy, what'd you think of it?
Well, yeah, since Wade and Charles have taken their turn making bold Oscar predictions,
yeah,
I'll do mine. I think American Factory, this documentary that's coming out on Netflix on Wednesday, is almost certainly going to be in the running commentary for Oscar documentary nominations. It's really terrific. It's really relevant. And what it's about is there's a GM factory in Dayton, Ohio that closed down, and this Chinese glass company takes it over. And so it's about this culture clash that happens. You know, we had movies like this in the 80s, comedies about, you know, the Japanese businessmen coming here making cars. And this is very much about that, except it's real. So you watch these Chinese employees take lessons in American culture that are not entirely flattering. And then you watch these employees who are at first very grateful to have jobs realize that the Chinese expectations of what a worker is supposed to do in a factory, what they're supposed to put up with, safety-wise, union-busting-wise, or union-prevention-wise, you know, it's very tough. This is a funny movie, but it's also incredibly relevant, and I really look forward to the conversations.
And this is made by the Obamas' production company,
this is one
right?
of the first things they came on board to say, like, we want to put our stamp on this.
All right. They have a deal with Netflix. This is streaming on Netflix starting the middle of next week, the documentary American Factory, directed by Stephen Bognar and Julia Reichert. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. And we'll be back with more reviews in 1 minute. A defender of Angry Birds wants to point out that Rotten Tomatoes has the highest score for any video game adaptation ever for Angry Birds 2. So
well, there's a distinction.
That's a qualification.
So well, I was going to say that's a limited point.
Yeah, and what about some of the Pokemon movies?
So it's a low bar, but
it's a very low bar. It includes Postal.
All right, we continue with Danish director Mads Brügger's film, the documentary Cold Case Hammarskjöld. Wade, what'd you think of this doc?
I was blown away. It's a very unconventional doc, the way it's put together. Mads Brügger kind of frames it around his own thought process. He sits there with a couple of transcribers, typists, who are transcribing his ideas and putting notes on a board. And that sort of frames out the structure for you as he's thinking it through. And it's revisiting the death of in 1961 of UN Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld, who died in a plane crash in Africa. And the speculation is, was he killed? Was he assassinated because he was looking to lead the African nations out of their colonial connections to their previous colonial European European nations that had colonized them, and sort of disconnect them economically from those countries and give them a sense of independence and freedom? Was he killed because of that? And you think, well, that's a little bit of a reach. You're kind of paranoid and you're a little bit of a weird Danish guy, but I'll indulge you. And about an hour later, I'm all in, because they don't just discover evidence. They discover proof. And people who are willing to talk. And in years in the making, he and this Swedish investigator who's working with him, they uncover not just that conspiracy, but tangential crimes and conspiracies and black ops things going on that just blow your mind. And it's really extraordinary what they've uncovered. And apparently the UN now is even investigating because of what they uncovered in this documentary.
Wow. Cold Case Hammarskjöld. Amy, what do you think?
Yeah, it's truly wild. And we're going to touch on this again, I think, later this show. Watching these documentarians, the new style type of documentarian, use these techniques from fiction and use sort of self-reflexivity, cast themselves in there.
Yeah.
Tell you, the audience, like, I've cast two people to play my secretary, even in this movie, and have them sort of give dialogue and questions and prompts. But yet, in the service of telling a true story here that really unfolds, you know, kind of like a thriller, like you're watching
it
Snowman or Girl with a Dragon Tattoo or the thrillers that have been coming out of Scandinavia lately. It feels like it could fit right in there. And one of the things he uncovers is, you know, ads for a group that is called the South African Maritime Institute, which sounds like a very banal name for a group that sounds like it's mercenaries. And he is able to find some of these people and ask them what happened when they were working for this group, not even in the 60s, but in the 80s, and what they were doing then. It's a really
terrifying
bone-chilling.
It is bone-chilling what they discover.
We're talking about the documentary from Mads Brügger, Cold Case Hammarskjöld. You can see it at the Alamo Drafthouse Cinema downtown L.A. and at Lemley's Monica Film Center, Santa Monica. The film is unrated. It was the Sundance winner, Best Director for Documentary Film in the World Cinema category. And John Horn of The Frame talked with director Mads Brügger on The Frame earlier this week. You can hear that interview by clicking on the link on the Film Week page at kpecc.org. Buñuel and the Labyrinth of the Turtles, a film that includes animation. It's primarily in Spanish. The director is Salvador Simo. Charles, what'd you think?
Well, we first saw this at Animationist Film last year, and I heard about it. I thought, well, that's a weird thing to try and animate. But it very quickly won me over. The story is so wonderfully improbable that Buñuel ran into a lot of trouble after L'Âge d'Or played. And a friend of his who was a sculptor said, I'm entering the lottery. If I win, I'll give you the money to make this film that you want to make about this impoverished area of Spain. He won the lottery. He gave him the money. And since you can't recreate a lot of this, they animate it, and it works surprisingly well for the most part. They intercut it with clips from the Buñuel film about this impoverished region. It's the land without bread. And I was surprisingly kind of charmed by it, that it was just so off the wall and so something that we're just not used to people doing in animation.
What do you think, Wade?
I agree. It is really intriguing. I don't think it's 100% successful, but it's really ambitious, so you can sort of forgive the rough edges in places. Las Hordas, Land Without Bread, was only a short film. It's only 30 minutes long. So it's unusual that you make a feature film about the making, a feature animated film about the making of a short live-action documentary from 1933. Buñuel didn't really hit his stride until he was a much older man, until he was in his 50s. That's when his 50s and 60s is when he made most of his real masterpieces. So this is, here he is, you know, a 33-year-old man thinking that he's failed and his first feature has flopped. And
he's
so
washed up.
He's washed up, you know, before he's even gotten out of the blocks. And so here he pulls together a skeleton crew and goes to this remote place and makes one of the great short documentaries of all time. And it is, what is really interesting to me is that they have the confidence in the animation to intercut live segments, actual film from this documentary with the animation, knowing that you are going to contrast how these characters have been drawn relative to how they actually looked. You're going to judge the animation now. You're going to judge the art based on the images that Buñuel shot in 1933. They have that much confidence in their animation, and that is really kind of encouraging.
Buñuel in The Labyrinth of the Turtles, animated film from Spain. Salvador Simo, the director and co-screenwriter. It's unrated at the New Art Theater in West L.A. The documentary Jay Myself is directed by Josh Alexander. It follows photographer Jay Mazel. Wade?
Love this. This is a conflict of interest number two for me this week. My friend Doug Blush was an executive producer and editor on this. Doug is kind of the elite editor in the documentary field. He's Oscar nominated almost every year. And what a great movie this is. We've covered so many movies about great photographers on Film Week over the years. And they're usually about people who they became alcoholics or they were never discovered or they died young and we never saw all of their photographs. And there's always some tragic twist.
Like that great, the story, the housekeeper was like that, all these incredible photos. I don't remember the name of the documentary, but it was extraordinary.
There's always a tragic twist. There is no tragic twist here. Jay Mazel is a great photographer. He bought this building in the 1950s, which is known as the Germania Building, right in the Bowery District, which, you know, an office building. An old New York office building, and put his gallery on one floor and a basketball court on another. And he's lived there with his wife and his daughter, and they've had a wonderful life. And it comes around, and it's time to, you know, time to move. Can't take care of the building anymore. So he sells it for $55 million. And this movie, it revisits his entire career while he has to move thousands of boxes of material out of this building before the deadline for the sale. He's rich beyond his wildest dreams because of a real estate sale, the biggest private real estate sale in New York history, and more than he ever made as a photographer. But in the process, we got to get all this stuff together.
It's
and
just
so
like
now
a weird episode of Hoarders or something.
It really is, but it's just, it's a wonderful, it's an opportunity for him and the filmmakers to revisit his life and career and his family and his wife and his daughter, and they're wonderful people. And you just fall in love with everyone in this movie. It is just such a wonderful trip.
And is much of this that the filmmakers are able in the style of the film to depict who he is as a person?
Absolutely. And he is really forthcoming. I mean, he's 88 years old, but he's still vibrant and he still has great stories to tell. And everyone around him is funny and they have great stories about him. And his photography is really extraordinary. He's not, you know, he's not a street photographer. He's an artist. And he takes pictures that are, you know, I mean, certainly some are well known, but mostly he's trying to paint with light and with composition. And it's just, it's beautiful.
Does he say what he's going to do with $55 million?
Yeah, he bought a $16 million place in Brooklyn.
Where downsizing.
He downsized a bit. Everything has to be in storage now, you know.
And yeah. Leaves him with a lot of money left over. Jay Myself, the documentary from Stephen Wilkes. Josh Alexander wrote the script for the documentary. It's unrated, and you can see it at Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles. Driven, a biographical thriller starring Lee Pace, Jason Sudeikis, and Judy Greer. Nick Hamm, the director. Colin Bateman, the screenwriter. Wade?
I'm just thrilled anytime Judy Greer shows up in a movie again. This is a very serviceable drama about the DeLorean scandal. Seen through the eyes of Jim Hoffman, who was the kind of sleazy neighbor who had a history with the FBI, became an informant, and basically turned state's evidence on DeLorean, and may or may not have embellished the stories. So everything is seen through the point of view of Hoffman, who's played by Jason Sudeikis. Lee Pace plays DeLorean. And it does kind of follow the Scorsese Goodfellas template a little bit, maybe a little too closely, but it's very competently made. Doesn't really do anything remarkable, but I will say Lee Pace is amazing as John DeLorean. Really, really gets under your skin and creeps you out.
What'd you think, Amy?
Yeah, the way that Lee Pace plays DeLorean is he plays him basically like a Gatsby figure. And in a lot of ways, that's what this film is. It's one hand a Gatsby story, a guy who looked at this rich neighbor he had, a guy who has himself, almost no moral compass at all.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
And that's sort of the way that Lee Pace plays. He sort of wanders through these giant parties where he's not having any fun, but he's very good at faking it. And so is everybody else. Everyone in this movie is very much just a spin maker, a spin artist, always lying to get themselves out of a jam. And when the film starts, it actually has kind of more of a slapstick comedy tone that I would say I was not that into. But as it deepens, as you spend more time with these people, it does become more of a tragedy, a bright colored kind of slapsticky tragedy, but a tragedy of people who just keep betraying each other. And I didn't realize how much I didn't really know about the DeLorean case and how much this film makes the argument that he was very much set up, but also his own hubris had a ton to do with it.
Film is Driven. It's at the AMC Universal City Walk, rated R. The Amazing Jonathan documentary, a documentary about the final tour of a dying magician, Benjamin Berman, the director. Wade?
Such a weird movie. So The Amazing Jonathan is an illusionist who showed up on lots of talk shows back in the 80s and 90s and now finds out that he has a terminal illness. So Ben Berman is a filmmaker who says, well, I'm going to make a documentary about him. And it seems like a fairly routine documentary about a guy who once had a great life and now he's suffering. Until suddenly the documentary crew becomes the subject of their own movie, because now there are all of these other documentary crews showing up making documentaries. And all of these weird twists and double crosses and triple crosses and sleights of hand start happening. And the question is, wait a minute, is this whole thing an illusion? Is the master of the sleight of hand, the master of illusion, pulling a joke on us while we're making a movie about him? And when the documentary becomes its own subject, when the documentarian starts interviewing himself and he has no idea what he's going to do and what's going on, it goes really deep into Weirdsville. And I don't know that I wound up loving it, but I couldn't stop watching it.
It sounds like an old Burns and Allen episode where George would look at the TV and comment on what was going on.
Yeah.
The Amazing Jonathan documentary, Amy.
Yeah, I mean, The Amazing Jonathan at the center of this, you really see him pit these different documentary crews against each other. He keeps bragging that not Ben Berman, but the other guys have won 2 Oscars, and insulting Ben Berman to his face, like, let them get this shot. I'll do this interview with them. And you start sort of getting angry at this man who has a fatal heart condition, which
you were supposed to love him initially, and now you're getting angry at him.
Exactly. And I think people's mileage with this documentary will depend on how charming you think Benjamin Berman is, this documentarian at the center of it, who then starts just putting himself in front of the camera. I didn't find him incredibly charming. I found him a little bit annoying.
Is there really another film? And is that to come?
A dive in. Yes, I found the other ones. I found at least one of them.
Yeah. But it's not even... See, I didn't need for him to be charming. I just needed to sort of enjoy how manic he was becoming. He's getting paranoid. He doesn't know what to do. He's like, I don't know he's just... he's flustered. And I really got... And I sort of got into the flustered aspect of it.
Can you imagine this guy traveling with, what, 3 documentary crews simultaneously?
Oh, you wish it was only 3.
Oh, it was more. The Amazing Jonathan documentary, this doc from Benjamin Berman at the Alamo Drafthouse Cinema downtown, the Lemley Playhouse Pasadena, and it's streaming on Hulu. The documentary is unrated. We have more films to review with our critics. We'll be back shortly. Film Film Week on 89.3 KPCC, Larry Mantle with critics Charles Solomon, Wade Major, and Amy Nicholson. Next up, the drama Low, Low, written and directed by Nick Ritchie, stars Ally Ritchie, Alexis Raich, and Casey Rogers. Wade?
Really, conflict of interest number three. I know Nick Ritchie.
You know too many people.
You're very famous and powerful.
I have to, full disclosure.
He's one of the beautiful people.
Yeah. I know Nick Ritchie and Ally Ritchie. Lovely husband and wife. She's an actress. He's a writer-director. And great family. Ally's sister, Hunter, was a contestant on American Idol some years ago and should have won. So very talented people. Very talented people here. And this is this kind of belongs to two genres at the same time. It belongs to the sort of the waste youth genre, which includes things like American Honey, you know, where you have kids that just sort of are aimless in life and don't know what they're going to do. And they're a little bit reckless. And eventually they sort of learn how to put it together, or hopefully they learn. And then there's also the L.A. independent film scene, where a lot of people here, because you have so much talent in town that isn't working, people make their own little independent films about, you know, life in Los Angeles. And they bring their friends and everybody into it and you know, try to make a mark. And the problem with both of those is that the first one is usually made by people who don't really know their subject. And the second one is usually made by people who really don't know how to make movies. Nick doesn't fall into either of those traps. This is a really interesting film about four young women who are now going to transition out of high school and into the next phase of their lives. Are they going to go to college? Probably not, because their grades aren't good enough and they're a little bit reckless and they come from broken families and bad backgrounds. So what are they going to do? School gave you structure. Now where does your life go? Now you have to grow up. And that's a real dilemma. And it's treated here with seriousness and maturity and insight and some really, really good performances by some terrific actors that really deserve to move on and do bigger and better things. It doesn't sort of go to the familiar parts of L.A. where you go, oh, I've been on that street. Oh, I was just there the other day. Finds little nooks and crannies and areas where the characters get to sort of shine in their environment. And it's put together very, very smartly.
Movie is Low, Low. It's unrated. You can see it at the downtown independent downtown L.A. The Japanese action film Kingdom is directed by Shinsuke Sato. Charles, what do you think?
Well, this is fantasy is putting it mildly for this film. It's based on a long-running manga that's been animated. It's about how the king of the warring state realm of Shin will eventually become the wicked emperor, the unifier of China, who builds the Great Wall. In this case, it's because he has, as an aspiring general, a former slave boy who has taught himself martial arts and swordsmanship to a fast and fantastic degree. They fall in with their palace rebellion. And once, you know, the ex-slave and the deposed king and the queen of the mountain people who could, as a sword-wielding Amazon, who could off Brie Larson without breaking a sweat, and a couple of other stalwart heroes come along, you know the 80,000-man army doesn't stand a chance against this band, and sure enough, they don't. And fists fly, and swords fly, and darts fly, and clubs fly, and halberds fly, and boots fly, and it's kind of nine-stop action. It's over the top, but it's kind of fun.
Kingdom.
It is totally bonkers, as Japanese period films tend to be, especially the ones that are based on mangas, the live-action ones at least. It's a little weird watching a what is basically Chinese history told in Japanese. That's a little bit weird, and it takes some getting used to. And I've seen so many, I mean, there have been so many movies and TV series made about the first emperor, and almost none of them bear any resemblance to reality or history. It's just a great vehicle to tell your stories. And the same thing here. There's no historical accuracy to this thing whatsoever. Half these characters never lived. None of this stuff ever actually happened. But you know what? It's a great skeleton on which to hang a really fun, bonkers period manga and live action film. And I had a blast with it. It takes some weird turns that you just don't see coming.
Kingdom is rated R. It's in select theaters.
I dreamt music.
remember that? Well, maybe if you saw the final cut of the iconic film Blade Runner, released in 1982, Harrison Ford's character Deckard dreams of a unicorn. It was cut from the original theatrical release of the film, but it was included in the final cut, which was supervised by Ridley Scott. And it's argued that that dream sequence dramatically changes the viewer's interpretation of the film and the Deckard character. On Film Week, we turn our attention to director's cuts of films, and whether it's for the best, whether it's for the worst, and the different reasons why we get multiple versions of a movie. Blade Runner is a great example, Wade, because, what, it's got four or five different versions.
Yeah, there were a whole bunch, and I've seen every single one of them in the theater. Every single time somebody said, oh, no, this is the definitive. Oh, no, sorry, that was a rough cut. No, this is the definitive. Oh, no, that was the... And it always turns out that what they found and what they thought was definitive was not. And eventually Ridley Scott just said, look, just stop it. I'll make you my definitive version. And he did. And it's brilliant.
The final cut.
It is, there are three reasons why we usually get these director's cuts. And this is the first and most important one, which is the director gets it taken away from them. And they don't actually get to deliver their favorite. Sometimes they have a change of heart after the fact. I generally don't like those. And then the third reason is because somebody at the studio said we need to release another DVD. Let's just go mercenary and make a director's cut just for the hell of it. And those are almost always superfluous with a lot of scenes that should have never been made put in the final film. But absolutely. Brazil and Blade Runner are like the two legendary ones of recent decades.
Yeah. Charles, this ever happened with animation?
It's rare, particularly in American animation, because everything is kind of pre-edited. You know, there are a couple of examples. They put the Human Again song back in Beauty and the Beast, and you realized, oh, it really does slow down the story. And Brad added a couple of scenes to The Iron Giant for its Blu-ray. There's the soup-eating sequence from Snow White. The one thing that sort of corresponds to what Wade was saying about Blade Runner is the series Neon Genesis Evangelion, one of the watershed anime series, where the director, Hideaki Anno, has never figured out how to end it. He did, it was a 26-episode series. Then he recut the last episodes. Then he did one feature that didn't satisfy anybody with an ending. He did a second feature that's the closest thing I've ever seen to animated schizophrenia. And now he's redoing the whole thing as four animated features. And he's done three of them. And everybody's waiting for number four and saying, can he end this story? But I would like to add, I think if there are director's cuts of some movies that are longer, there should be audience cuts of others that are shorter.
I love that idea.
In which case, like The Green Mile and Sheltering Sky will come in at about 10-minute shorts.
Solomon's Law.
Okay. Well, it's funny, Amy, because, we've got Apocalypse Now Final Cut, which just had its premiere. This is the version that Francis Ford Coppola says he finally likes. There was Apocalypse Now Redux, mm-hmm. which had 50 minutes of extra footage that came
long
out.
That bit on the French plantation up the river. The weird,
So the new one, the final cut now, is like 3 hours long.
I'm not sure I have any patience for that, to be honest. I mean, the Coppolas and the Ridley Scotts of the world, the tinkerers who can't ever put a film down, I don't always want to go with them on the mission. I would prefer to see director's cuts by, like, say, Ari Aster, who did Midsommar this year. He has a cut that's 30 minutes longer. That feels like he knew the movie he wanted to make. It was just going to be extra long. If you really liked Midsommar and you want to see it, yes. But it feels like a remake with an end in sight and not just endless bits of tinkering by people who I feel like could just commit already and tell the story they want to say.
It's true. Coppola can't stop tinkering with Apocalypse. There was never a problem there. That original cut was his desired cut. With Ridley Scott, it's a little different and in every single case. With Blade Runner, it was taken away from him originally.
And the voiceover added.
And the happy ending.
With Legend, Sid Sheinberg took that away from him and mutilated it just like he did with Brazil. But Terry Gilliam was able to prevail because he took that full page ad out in Variety and said, Mr. Sheinberg, when are you going to release my movie?
This Universal Sid Sheinberg we're talking about.
Although one, I would say, agree with what Amy was saying about the... Oh, I'm sorry.
We'll pick up that thought as we continue with Charles Solomon, Amy Nicholson, Wade Major. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. This The Mantle Cut. We'll be back. We're now going to restore Charles Solomon's contribution to Film Week.
Yeah, he was agreeing with me, Larry, and you cut him off.
And I'm sorry, I had to cut him off for a break.
We found that missing audio. I was going to say that I think one other director's cut that really worked were Peter Jackson's longer versions of The Lord of the Rings, where the rhythm just seemed to work better that way, and the films felt shorter, and the story better told. But I think that's unusual. I think that if you had needed it, you would have realized it in the beginning, and you would have made the movie that way.
And Wade, Michael Mann actually did a shorter version that was his director's cut.
So Last of the Mohicans was originally released at 112 minutes, and then he did a director's cut, or a director's expanded edition of 117 minutes, and then he went back to that and cut it down to 114 minutes for his definitive version. So it kind of kept, it inflated a little bit at first, and then he cut it back.
Sounds like a concertina. That's going back and
But the 114-minute version of that, I do think, is the best version. I think he finally got it right.
Do you all agree with The Lord of the Rings that the later versions were the better?
More story.
I mean, for people like my mother, who's an obsessive and wants to see everything, I mean, what I think is interesting is
wait a minute.
I mean, Lord of the Rings, which is now becoming a TV show. You know, I think there's something interesting in this moment we're in right now where the line between TV, film, and streaming is so blurred that we're watching filmmakers have a chance to tell these stories in longer versions, the way that Quentin Tarantino put a longer version of Hateful Eight up, more as an episodic on Netflix. And I feel like the boundaries between a 90-minute film, a two-hour film, a four-hour something or other, whatever you want to call it on Netflix, are so permeable right now. It's really interesting to see people be able to play with that.
Did he ever put out a reconstructed Kill Bill with both parts put together?
Not yet. And there may still be a third part to it. That's still in the conversation. Quentin can't stop teasing us. I do want to say, if not for the director's cut of Brazil, I probably wouldn't be here, because Brazil...
victory.
Thank you. Brazil only got released after that ad, when the LA Film Critics gave it Best Picture of the Year before it had even been released, when it may not even have ever been released. And they forced that release. And that's when I said, I want to be one of those guys.
He said, I want to make trouble.
I want to make trouble.
Amy, do you have a favorite director's cut that you thought, I mean, made a film you didn't feel as strong about, outstanding for you?
Well, you know, favorite is a strong word, but I have a choice that I think was very smartly made, which is when Steven Spielberg took E.T. and he did a different director's cut. He didn't change that much about it, but what he did is he swapped out all the guns in the climactic ending sequence with walkie-talkies to kind of de-cool the gun imagery and also de-frighten it for kids in the generation who were very scared by that ending. And I do like the idea of us looking back at the films of the past and being able to say slightly, like, I am tired of having so many guns in the scene. Why do we need so many guns? Like, is there a way to tell the story slightly differently? And I think that's smart.
All right. There are other films, Wade, I know you wanted to talk about, including Once Upon a Time in America.
Yeah, I mean, Once Upon a Time in America, most famously, Sergio Leone was forced to release that in a really truncated cut that was chronological and didn't sort of jump in time the way that his longer version does, which is a masterpiece. I mean, you know, I saw it originally at 2.5 hours and, oh, that's OK. And then when you see it at 4 hours, you think, oh, this is just extraordinary. But who wanted to release a 4-hour movie at that time? Lawrence of Arabia, also very famously, was hacked to pieces over the first part of its release by Columbia and Sam Spiegel, who produced it, because it was too long, right? It was 4 hours, and then it became, you know, 3 hours and 50 minutes, and then it was like 2 hours and 40 minutes, and they're all
that was an event film. I'm surprised they would cut
that. That was a major thing you went to.
It was, you know,
drinks.
They it just wound up being butchered into a bunch of different lengths at a certain point, and David Lean had to come back in the 90s, early 90s, and put together a definitive cut, which is now the cut that everyone sees. But they had to go back and get Anthony Hopkins to imitate some of the voices. No, it wasn't Anthony Hopkins. No, it was Peter O'Toole did his own voices, and somebody else did some of the others. But they had to bring people back to re-record voices and you know, because they'd lost the soundtrack. So that was a really bit of an epic restoration too.
Well, when we talk about these things that are lost, I mean, I think about when they found the lost footage of Metropolis that had been lost for 80 years, because these prints, you know, would tour the country in different sort of versions, and then a lot of them would get destroyed, burned, lost. And when you find an old print of a movie that fills in some of the gaps that were cut out of ours, and you're able to restore it and have people say, like, oh, now I understand what they were doing with the robot army a little bit better.
Yeah.
I think it's so exciting to be able to cling on to something before it's completely
gone. Yeah, and there's so many of those films. I mean, The Star is Born.
Yeah, that Ron Haver restored.
With the Judy Garland, James Mason version of the film.
No, you were reminding me, Wade, with that of the film we know as Godzilla.
Yeah.
That, you know, Americans had only seen in a badly chopped up version. Now that's finally been put back together to what it really should be. Is.
Now, did Raymond Burr survive the cut or not?
I don't think he has. I don't think he's as prominent.
Okay.
Also worth mentioning, I know Charles is going to jump on me for this, but, Coppola restored The Cotton Club to a director's cut that elevated Gregory Hines and his brother's character to equal status with that of Richard Gere and Diane Lane. That premiered last year at festivals, and for whatever reason, MGM is refusing to release it. So go figure. I've tried to get an answer to that question. I haven't gotten one.
That's another one I'd want an audience cut for.
I'm one of those who defends Cotton Club, even the original cut of that film. Close Encounters, you were mentioning E.T. earlier. Close Encounters of the Third Kind as a director's cut?
There were two different cuts. Yeah, he did the special edition, and then everyone said, we don't really want to see that ending. We like the ambiguous ending. We don't want to see Richard Dreyfuss sort of go inside. And then so that was that rather mercenary effort was deleted. And then there was a more comprehensive cut that brought other stuff in but took the special edition ending off, and that's the version that sort of is now official. But all of them, if you buy it on 4K Blu-ray, you will get all of them. They are all on it.
So interesting how it's these big directors we're talking about, you know, Coppola, Spielberg, Leone. I mean, people of this stature we're talking about doing director's cuts, or Ridley Scott. But I wonder, are there, you know, lesser directors who ever get this opportunity to put together a film that a studio might have butchered?
I mean, sort of. It depends on how much you like the remixes of, say, Anchorman 2 or the 40-year-old version, where they're just like, we have so many more jokes that we probably were great to cut. But do you want to see them just in case? Are you a completist?
They're still doing restored and added versions of the Orson Welles movies.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, good point. You're mentioning about Ward Kimball spending a year on animating a scene that was cut.
The scene in Snow White where the dwarves eat the soup that she's cooked for them. You see them washing up to do. And there was a song about the music in your soup from your slurping. And Kimball, who became one of the nine old men, was so angry when Walt said, I'm sorry, we have to cut it. It holds up the story. He marched off and he was ready to quit and was going to read Walt the Riot Act. And Walt did what only he could do. He started talking about the next movie. And there was this wonderful cricket character that Ward was going to animate so brilliantly. And Ward said, you know, I floated back to my desk. And that was something everybody who worked with Disney had, that experience that he could enchant you with the next project if you had any problems with this one. And you'd go back and they all said, you know, a day or two later, you'd say, damn it, he did it again.
And did the soup eating scene ever go back in, or you just have to watch it in isolation?
You see it in isolation because it wasn't inked and painted. It was just animated.
Quick shout out for Richard Donner's Superman 2 cut. He was fired from Superman 2. He never got his name on it, but he that's available on Blu-ray as well.
All right, very good. Thank you all so much. Amy Nicholson, Wade Major, Charles Solomon joining us as our critics this week on Film Week here on 89.3 KPECC. And you can share your favorite director's cuts or later cuts of films subsequently released theatrically or on disc on our Film Week page at kpecc.org. I look forward to talking with you next time, Film Week Fridays at 11, Saturdays at noon, right here on 89.3 KPECC, and have a great weekend.